They say poker is a hard way to make an easy living. This is the podcast about people that make poker work for them. This is Mid Stakes Living.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mid Stakes Living podcast brought to you by TournamentPokerEdge.com. Actually, the very first episode of the new year, 2017, is here. Matt, how was your 2016?
2016 was a mixed bag. There was some good, there was some bad. I got married. There was some less good stuff. So let's hope the good stuff continues this year and the bad stuff stops. So happy new year to all our listeners, by all means.
Yeah, hopefully everybody out there had a great 2016 and is putting together plans to make 2017 even better. And hopefully we'll have lots of great episodes of the Mid Stakes Living podcast for you guys.
Fingers crossed.
So let's jump right into it. Very excited today. I think our second Irish player, if I'm correct.
Oh, my God. Did you just say that? My God.
Already a mistake.
Oh, no.
You can edit that one out, Derek.
No. Leave that in. Everybody thinks I'm Irish. Everybody. It's become a bit of a running joke. So my Irish friends are going to love that one. So leave that one.
Okay. Well, we shall leave that in. But I guess
I really did my research this morning, too. And I thought,
you worked hard. You worked really hard.
Someone needs to go on like a tour of the U.S. educating Americans about different accents in the British Isles, because Ian's accent is very much not Irish, as I'm sure you'll attest, Ian.
I will attest to that. Yeah.
All right. So bad start, but that's okay.
Our
guest today, Ian Simpson. More, I think, from what I understand, a little bit more of a live pro, although it sounds like you've kind of transitioned over to playing a fair amount of online recently as well. So welcome to the show, Ian.
Thank you very much for having me.
Welcome.
So since it is the new year, or very close to it, it's January 4th as we're recording this, why don't we start off by actually just getting a quick recap from you on how your 2016 was, highs, lows, you know, some of the highlights for you.
Both, which I think is pretty standard for poker players, right? As you know, there's always ups and downs. Live, it's been a bit of a tough year. I've had like a few near misses, like a few deep runs that could have really made it a really, really good year, as opposed to a sort of mediocre sort of year. Online's been really good. I actually won the online leg of the GPPT, which was a massive online highlight for me. Like you said, I am one of the rare players who actually transitioned to online from live rather than the other way around.
That's pretty rare.
Yeah, I mean, I played online since I was, you know, my 18th birthday, essentially, but I never really played online to a good standard, never really put in the work to play it at a good standard. But it's only the sort of this past year, a bit more than a year, that I've really sort of put in the work, done the study necessary to be able to beat the online game. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a completely new challenge to the live game for sure.
Sure, yeah. So you're enjoying it so far, then? It's not become too much of a grind already.
I still have the hunger for it. I still really enjoy it. It can get a little bit depressing. There's different emotional swings that you've got to get used to for the online game instead of the live game, because you can get to like 3 a.m. and your last tournament's your smallest buy-in tournament, and it's like, oh, for God's sake, now it's 3 a.m, I really want to go to bed, but I can't waste a buy-in. Because I think that's a big part of everyone's, a big part of a lot of players leak online. Like, they might be a very technically good player, but they don't appreciate just how important that last tournament is. It doesn't matter if it's some $5 bull on you know, one of the smaller sites. Like, if these little tournaments at the end of the sessions don't get treated with respect, they really, really eats into your hourly rate, and you know, it can really make the difference between being a winning player overall and a losing player overall, at least I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important thing for people to realize. I think so many people focus very much on strategic insight as like the only way to improve, you know, but if in reality, if you take every tournament 50% more seriously than you previously did, that's a pretty big improvement right there without even actually getting any better at poker, you know?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Mindset's a big part of the battle of this game.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So going back a little further, you know, thinking about the fact that you've sort of transitioned from live to online, How was it that you sort of got into poker in the first place and ended up becoming a live pro?
Well, my dad taught me when I was 5 years old.
Five years old, of course.
Five card draw, not Texas Hold'em. Like a rainy day in the Lake District. It's the place in England, which is notorious for being cold, wet, and miserable, even when it's summer. So it was literally on a holiday there. We're playing five card draw around the kitchen table in the caravan. And I loved it ever since. Played with my friends with a bag of pennies just for play money. Turned 18, realized you could play online, loved life, had a go, did all right. Whether it was a little bit of run good and a little bit of it being the good old days where money was easy to come by online. Just play aggressive and win.
Those were the days. Strategy,
bet and it'll be okay.
Yeah.
which was, you know, that seemed to get me a few thousand dollars. But then I remember doing in a whole lot of my bankroll, almost accidentally on purpose. Sort of, I realized what the risk was. I was, I realized I couldn't be, well, at the time I didn't think I could make a living from poker. And I wanted to be a teacher. So I was doing my teaching qualification and I realized that I was going to make teaching a career. I was going to be teaching till I was 60, 70 years old. Now, if you're a teacher, you can't play the World Series because in England you can't get any extra time off from teaching and the World Series lands within sort of school time.
Yeah, I have friends who are teachers, so I think they've been through that.
yeah. My wife can never join me in Vegas because she's a teacher too. So when I go out to Vegas, she's stuck at home and it's not exactly fair. So I sunk like a hell of a lot of the money I'd made knowing that I had a safe wage coming in to try and settle it into the last World Series I'd ever be able to play. And... terrible financial decision, made even worse by the fact that I bricked everything. So yeah, that was pretty terrible. but then I became a teacher and I did sort of 60, 70 hours a week and didn't really have much time for poker at all, except the occasional live satellite. So I satellited into the Irish Open. And the company running the Irish Open, they had a last longer bet for €100,000 sponsorship package.
Wow.
And they said, yeah, so whoever lasted the longest out of all the online qualifiers got this sponsorship package. And that was me, because I got fourth.
Right.
So, now, like I just said, poker and teaching do not line up whatsoever. If you want to do teaching properly, you've got to put in at least 60 hours, probably more like 70. And the tournaments available aren't usually within the teaching holidays. There's EPT Barcelona in the summer, but that's about it, really. On the Irish Open during the Easter holidays, but that's it. Mm-hmm. So, and 50k of this 100k had to be spent on tournaments. So I was kind of muscled into giving up this job that I absolutely loved. I absolutely adored teaching. It was it might sound silly, choice between a 100k sponsorship package and teaching, but I absolutely adored teaching. But I did take the sponsorship package and said, okay, well, I'm leaving for a year. And I came back, and I had an okay year, like especially for an amateur playing way out of his depth. Because like in order to spend 50k in tournament buy-ins, I can't just go and play 200 quid games in London, or whatever. I've got to go and play APTs, you know.
Right.
And for somebody who hadn't played for 5 years because he'd been a teacher, that's a little silly. The more that I think about it. So I did okay. I think that was the 50k buy-ins. I think I turned it into like 40 or something. So it was kind of like losing 10k. Sort of, but that was 40k more than nothing, if that makes sense.
Right, yeah.
But I had one more tournament to go, and it was the Irish Open. And I went back, and I won the thing.
Wow.
Which was a little bit nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was for how much? I think I saw somewhere it was 200 and something thousand euros?
265.
Wow.
Nice. Actually, on that trip, I had already planned to propose to my wife on that trip to Dublin. Because Dublin's like a special place for me and Emma. It's just silly and sentimental for us. And it was before the Irish Open happened. So I had the ring in my pocket the entire time for the final table. And I was going to do it the next day in a place called St. Stephen's Green. If you know Dublin, St. Stephen's Green.
Oh, I do know Stephen's Green, yeah.
Beautiful little place. Lovely little park. I was going to do it there. But when I got to the final table, I realized that all my family were watching the stream. And all my now wife's family was watching the stream. So I decided no matter where I finish, I'm going to do it on stream. So I did it on stream. Thankfully, I won. If I'd come second and then proposed, I think that would have been really, really awkward. Like, coming in any other position and then proposing would be fine, because then they'd get finished up and play the tournament. But if I came second and I was just like, yeah, sorry, mate, I'm going to steal your thunder. Your second best. That would have been really awkward. So I'm really glad I won and didn't come second. Like, third would have been fine. But the second would have been really awkward. And thankfully, she said yes. So that's how poker happened for me.
Wow, that's pretty special. I think that's the first instance we've heard on this podcast of someone effectively being forced to quit their job to be a poker player rather than voluntarily doing so. So that's a pretty unique story.
It's bizarre, right?
Yeah, it's a little bit bizarre. So how did you find the transition there? Was it? It's got to be somewhat uncomfortable to actually basically be forced out of a job that you like for the sake of essentially doing something which is pretty much just designed to get you to make you more money, you know. Was that a bit uncomfortable?
Very. I mean, I still miss the altruism of teaching, mm-hmm. As opposed to poker, which is very much a selfish entity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the hours are very different, and the stress levels are very different. Like, I remember being a teacher, I was really, really stressed out. Poker's a different kind of stress. I don't really know how to describe it. I'm still stressed out with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very different. It can be really, it's a bizarre sort of mindset you've got to be in to be a poker player. You've got to be okay losing all the time. Mm-hmm. Just all the time.
Having taught in the past myself, I think that the best way I would describe it is that teaching, there's more of a stress because it's responsibility and time pressure and things like that.
Absolutely,
whereas you are, it's all stuff you're in control of. Whereas poker, the stress comes from the fact that you're never going to have that much control, but you want to have more control, if you see what I mean. So it's more like,
yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah,
with teaching, you have responsibility, but you also have the control, so it's manageable. But in poker, you don't have the control, so it's so hard to ease back and not kind of be caught up in it, you know.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. That is the exact difference in the stress levels of it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. At least with teaching, you know you're still going to get paid at the end of the week.
Yeah, that is a nice thing.
Even if you had a bad week, you weren't the best teacher that week, but you're still going to get paid.
Yeah.
But when you're not the best poker player that week, you just pretty much lose money.
Yeah, you just lose money.
Yeah, you don't come away from the end of a week of teaching and then your boss is like, you owe me like $500 or something.
that would be an interesting incentive for teachers, right?
Well, it would be...
They need another one.
Yeah, exactly. I think at this point, if there's one underappreciated profession, at least certainly in the UK, it's probably teachers. So I think the last thing teachers need is to be told that they might lose money in a week of teaching.
I'm not kidding. I don't endorse this idea whatsoever.
Distance yourself from that one rapidly.
Don't hear this idea, because that would be really bad.
Well, I think there's a lot of stuff that if you took it out of poker and applied it to other stuff, it just doesn't work, you know. So
no.
I think that's going on that list.
Absolutely.
I'm curious, Ian. I'm curious about the. So you had this 100K package, and it sounds like it was kind of coming to an end right when you had this big score.
Yes.
So before the big score at the end of it, were you kind of thinking, okay, well, you know, I'm going to have this last tournament. It's going to be a bunch of fun, and then I'm going to get married, and I'm going to go back to teaching. Was that kind of the plan?
That was the plan.
Yeah. So then all of a sudden you ship, and you just go, okay, well,
I'll play a little longer, and then things keep happening in the poker world, so I'm sticking with it for now.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't help that teaching's getting worse and worse. Like, I remember when I was teaching, I think I was doing 60-hour weeks, sometimes 70, stressed out of my head, but I still loved it. Now, my mm-hmm. wife's a teacher, so I've been able to sort of watch teaching without being a teacher, and the stress levels are just going up and up and up and up. There's more and more being put onto teachers, and it's just becoming such a bit of a nasty profession. Like, and they're not paid fairly either. Like, it's really hard to get someone with a maths degree to teach maths, because teaching for a maths teacher is about the lowest paid job you can get with a maths degree.
Yeah. There's a lot of people involved in managing the education system who've never been teachers.
It boils my fluids. It really does.
I'm sure it does, because it does for every other person I know who's a teacher.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the most frustrating thing. And you get the same in other areas as well. It seems like almost every area in politics, it's not because someone's there because they've got experience in it. It's because, you know, their friends put them in, the politician chums have put them in that position, or at least that's what it feels
like. In a funny way, I suppose we actually see that from time to time in poker, don't we? Because I suppose that there's a very small number of people involved in managing overarching kind of aspects of the poker industry that are that have actually been poker players. And I think the a lot of the changes that we're seeing in the last few years that have actually come in poker have probably at least partially come because the people managing things now are people who are very disconnected from the game. You know, when you had guys who were former pros managing some of the biggest companies in the industry, it was probably a lot more player friendly, you know, so there's a lot of interesting changes there. Sorry, carry on.
Sorry, there is an exception to that rule. Unibet are very heavily, they've got a lot of former pros on their staff.
Okay.
Which is why I think the Unibet festivals and the Unibet site, well, the Unibet festivals are the most fun poker events I've been having in the past 3 years, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the exception. You're absolutely right. The people at the top in the other poker sites aren't necessarily ex-poker players. They're not necessarily motivated in the same way to make it fun that we would perhaps like. So yeah, very good point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's interesting at least to see that there's a lot of different companies out there with different philosophies. And I'm hoping that at the very least, I'm hoping that somewhere down the line, we'll start to kind of reach a point where there doesn't seem to be this sort of push and pull between players and site operators. You know, at this point, it seems to be like it almost seems to be one against the other in a lot of contexts. So it would be nice to see an environment in the future where that didn't necessarily happen. But at the same time, I suppose in almost every other industry, you see consumers up against companies pretty frequently. So it's hard to really see how as poker gets bigger and bigger, it's hard to see how that can be avoided. So it's an interesting one. But I'm curious, actually, just thinking about the fact that you've kind of stepped into the online environment more so in the last year or so. Is there anything that you've noticed coming into this environment that's kind of taken you by surprise about the online games?
What do you mean? Can you give me an example?
I suppose not really strategic stuff, just about the way that players tend to like the way that online players tend to approach the game compared to the players you might have been more accustomed to playing with live. You know, do you think there's
definitely
a lot of crossover?
It's two different games. Like, I just had a trip to Prague, and I was fortunate enough to be invited by David Lappin and Dara O'Kearney and Jason Tompkins, and they're all online grinders who are way better than me. And watching how they approach the game was really insightful. And they've just got a slightly different mindset, and they're all like good friends, so they've all sort of helped each other with their development. But my development was very sort of thrown in at the deep end. I didn't have a group of friends to talk poker about. Like my first poker trip, I was completely by myself. I was, you know, completely in the deep end, didn't know anyone. I had a very different sort of development. So watching just how they approach games and how they manage themselves was very different to how I did it. Especially when it comes to the online game as opposed to live, because a big part of the online game is managing your sort of expenses and this, that, and the other, whereas online it's more about putting in volume and worrying about, you know, sort of finding the very best games and stuff like that. So yeah, there is a big difference between the two.
Sure. So is there anything now that, you know, having grinded online a little bit, that if you could go back and do your live career again, would you do things differently?
I always find these sort of time travel questions sort of an interesting one. I always kind of think, well, I kind of needed to make that mistake. The best way to learn is to make mistakes. But I know what you mean. I think one of the interesting points that I'm sort of having the internal debate about is sort of ICM and the sort of the playing to win dynamic as opposed to the playing for a living kind of dynamic.
Yeah.
It's very glamorous to play for the win. When I first started, well, you know, I'm playing a tournament. Of course I want to win. That's why you play a tournament, to come first. Mm-hmm. But that mentality has to be tempered a bit. Especially, I think you have to temper it a bit more online than live, I do believe. Because live playing for the win, you can really put the pressure on and show that fearlessness. Whereas online, that's really countered by, well, your opponents just press call if you're playing too many hands.
Yeah.
If you play too many hands live and put the pressure on, especially on a bubble live, it's a lot more effective than online because there's a bit more of an emotional attachment to a big live tournament, whereas an online tournament, you can literally press call, lose, regen of the tournament.
Right. So, yeah, absolutely. You have to treat things a little bit differently. And I think it's always, but like ICM, I find is one of the, I mean, not to get too strategic with things, but I find that people, I find that people have a really interesting attitude to it, or it, it kind of shows you a little bit about the way people perceive the game as a whole. Because if you watch any of the live stream, you know, major tournaments like the EPTs or anything, or I suppose not, not anymore the EPTs, but, in the past, the EPTs when they still existed, every final table, you get people tweeting in and texting in and things like that saying, you know, the play for the win, forget ICM and like just, you know, never make a deal, you know, just gamble it up. And like inevitably every single one of these people is someone who's never played a poker tournament for that amount of money. So,
of course.
So the thing that I find most interesting is that the poker in the media and on TV and in movies and things has kind of created this impression for people that it's all about, being able to, it's all about who has the most gamble in them, you know, and, people who aren't as familiar with poker tend to get caught up in that. And it's this strange thing where theoretically we want people to believe that it's all about who has the most gamble, because we want people to get into it without really acknowledging how much skill there is involved. But at the same time, we as poker players don't really want people to think that we're just random gamblers. So we have this weird conflict of interest there where we're trying to protect the image of poker, but we're also trying to do it without detracting people from the game, because we kind of need people to be willing to gamble in order to attract new players.
You know? That is an interesting dichotomy there.
It's pretty tough to reconcile it sometimes. At least if you talk to family members and things like that, sometimes you'll have. I mean, I've been in conversations, maybe not necessarily with family, but with friends sometimes, where you have one person who has a really positive impression of it, because it's like, oh, you play this great game. It's such a skill based thing, and then the other person will be like, no, it's just gambling, and
you're
and
gonna lose
it's
all
like
your money.
How you know like obviously the truth is going to be somewhere in between the two, but how do you manage to sort of, like, I don't know, negotiate between those two sides of it. Have you ever come into any sort of resistance from friends or family about your poker career, or has it been very smooth for you, the transition? Everyone been supportive?
Very smooth. Like I say, my dad taught me cards when I was 5.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, he's been a gambler all his life. His dad, my gramps before him, was a gambler all his life. He was a losing gambler, so I've heard. my gramps was a losing gambler, my dad's a winning gambler, and now I've continued the trend, so hopefully I'll do the same with my kids. I've never really had too much resistance from friends or family, at least no one that knows me well. I've had a few sort of distant friends or friends of friends who've been a bit like gambling averse, which is an okay mindset to have. It's, you know, it's a safe mindset to have. I'll just sort of explain to them, look, it's not exactly gambling. It's, you know, I'll just explain to them a very basic example of the maths behind it. I'll flip a coin and say, I'll give you £1.05 every time it lands on heads, and you give me £1 every time it lands on tails. How many times do you want to flip this coin? And I'll say, well, that's kind of what poker's all about. It's about having a small edge. Of course, you're going to lose a bunch of times, but in the long term, you'll win.
That's funny. I used that exact same explanation to... this is completely true. Like about a week ago, I got a message from a Facebook friend of mine that I haven't spoken to in probably literally, I would say, 6 years at least.
Yeah.
And he was asking me to validate his supposedly winning roulette strategy. and that immediately you can see how much of a recipe for a disastrous conversation this is. And I had to. It took several messages before I could get to the point of using that specific analogy to explain to him why roulette is a bad idea, because I was using that to say basically every time you play roulette you get a certain amount when you win and you lose more than that every time you lose. So I had to really boil it down to the simplest terms for this guy to understand why roulette was a bad idea. And it's funny how some people have a perception about gambling that's so negative, but then there's other people who it seems really easy for them to kind of fall into this trap of believing that they're the first person who's just figured out roulette for all the all the time that it's existed, you know. And I've heard that stuff for blackjack and baccarat and
everything.
All these other gambling games. There's always a certain few people who are like, oh, I've got this strategy and nobody's ever thought of this before, and I'm going to beat every casino in the world using this strategy. And it's funny how people on both sides, there's a certain group of people that doesn't step back and just take a moment to really consider what it is they're suggesting about the reality of some of these gambling games. So it's always interesting to see people's perception.
Absolutely. Was this strategy to keep doubling his bets by any chance?
It was pretty close to that. Yeah, I think it. Yeah. I don't think I really let him get into the detail of it because I was like, no, stop. Just I know what you're going to say.
Yeah.
I know what the Martingale strategy is. just don't. You know.
Wait, that doesn't work.
And the funny thing is, this is not even the first person that I've had to explain to that Martingale is bad. And I don't have that many people in my life who question me about gambling that often. Yeah. But the few times it's happened, it's been people telling me that, or it's been people asking me, does the Martingale strategy work? And and it's just funny how that one idea seems to never go away. You know, it's just kind of a weird one.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, one of the fun ones I have, I'll be out for drinks with a bunch of friends. And they'll say, "Oh, look, there's a casino. Ian, you know how to play. Let's go. Yeah. Let's go to the casino and win." And I'm like, "You either want to watch me play cards for an hour, which won't be fun, and I'm really drunk, so it's a good idea, or you don't understand how those buildings work."
It is amazing how often I'm sure this has happened to you guys too. Like, I'll have a sort of not really close friend will hit me up and say, "Hey, if I give you $100, could you play a poker tournament and win, and then give me the money?" And I'm like, no, that's not how I roll. Sorry.
You know what? Weirdly, that has never actually happened to me. I've had all kinds of other weird inquiries. I had a guy ask me one time when I told him I was backed to play online MTTs. He asked me, "So is somebody going to break your legs if you lose?" I had that question, but I've never had anyone ask me if I can double their $100 for them or something like that. So I'm waiting on that one. I'm sure that one's going to come in like 3 years' time.
Excellent.
What about you, Ian? Any weird ones like that?
I've had a friend who said, "If I give you £20, will you gamble it for me?" She didn't expect me to play a £20 tournament. It was just the next time I'm playing a big live tournament, could she have a piece of it? I did cash, so I managed to make her a few quids. That was good. So I just give her a no markup piece of myself. You know, I occasionally do that with friends and family.
Yeah, I suppose that's probably the best way to counter somebody who says, "Can you turn my $100 into whatever else?" You know, just offer them through them, offer them a piece of something rather than just being like, "No, don't be silly. That's not how it works." And you know, because then you kind of turn them off to the idea of poker altogether if you just tell them, "No, you're being a dumbass." You know,
yeah.
So that's a good point.
It's nice to be able to kind of accommodate people in that way. Like last summer in Vegas, I had a lot of my friends. Like I had like friends from high school getting in touch on Facebook when I posted that I was selling pieces for Vegas, you know. So it's kind of nice to be able to incorporate people into your poker experience, because poker is such an isolated thing a lot of the time. So
I was just going to make that exact same point. Some of my best rails over Facebook and whatnot are from my sort of friends who don't have any clue about poker, but now do, because they've railed me. And now, actually, I've got one friend who learned high low after having bought action from me. So he was just playing on some free poker site.
Uh-huh.
She learned high low. I made a post the other day that I tried to register a high low game, registered an Omaha high only game, and lost a bunch of money. And she messaged me. She messaged me with strategy, so which was great, because she played it like a lot more than me. So she was like, "You can do this, and this is what I've learned." And so we had a great conversation about it. That was fun.
That is fun. Do you play a lot of mixed games then?
I've literally just started. I've played less than 100 hands of Omaha High Low. I love it.
Wow.
I love it already.
Yeah, I like mixed games.
Yeah, I don't know them very well at all, and I really want to play a bunch more of them because they seem like fun.
Absolutely. Every time I play mixed games, it makes me feel the same way I did when I first started out playing Hold'em, you know, because I feel like a total beginner, and I feel like I have to really concentrate to figure out what the hell's going on, because it's certainly some of the games on Stars, like, I don't know if you've ever played any of the, like, six-card PLO or Courchevel or any of these other weird games that they have, but I love playing those because they're so abstract from No Limit Hold'em that it actually forces you not to be in autopilot mode. You really have to think about it, because it's a totally transformed game. So I really hope there's a big mixed game boom over the next like 5 years or so, because I would love that so much, because it would really rekindle my sort of excitement to to get into new games again, you know, because I feel like, I mean, I've played God knows how many million hands of Hold'em over the last 5 years, yeah. and I'm sure everybody who gets to that point starts to feel a bit robotic with it, you know. Even if your game keeps improving, you still feel like there's only a certain scope of things that can possibly happen in a Hold'em tournament, you know. So it's good that mixed games seem to be growing in popularity. That's cool. Sorry,
I did have one little bit of a hiccup with this sort of Omaha high-low learning experience. And yeah. I thought to myself, okay, well, I'll load up a really small stakes Omaha high-low game sort of on my wind down on a Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And it takes up so much brain space learning a new game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, and I was literally getting a headache, like trying to figure out, okay, so I've got this hand, I've got that hand, this is high, this is low. Might win half the pot. Ooh, I could get quartered. Oh my god. And at the same time, then I sort of realize and think, oh, actually, I've got a big hand in this 109 comp that I really need to figure out, but my brain hurt. So
yeah.
So I think one discipline at a time until I'm a lot better at high-low.
Yeah, absolutely. I have no idea how people like – I mean, I read something a while back about Jason Mercier and his like 12 tabling mixed games during Scoop and playing like these 1K buy-in deuce to seven single draw events. And he's like – and at the same time, he's playing like a $500 – stud event and things like that, and he's having to like remember dead cards and remember draws and like all of this stuff, and I have no idea how that people do it. Like, I know Mercy has probably played thousands and thousands of hands at these games, but like it's absolutely insane.
Yeah, that would be multi-tabling trying to remember dead cards. That must be, I would love to be inside his mind just for like an hour.
Yeah.
It must be crazy in there, right?
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine. And and obviously it's fascinating to me that he has such an aptitude for live tournaments on top of that, you know, because the skill set required to be very, very good at multi-tabling online, it's very different from the live thought process. You know, you have to be able to completely slow it down. So it requires two, I wouldn't say entirely different skill sets, but two very different skill sets, obviously. And Mercier clearly has them in both respects, since he's had so much success on both fronts. It's incredible, really.
Yeah,
it makes you wonder if that's why he makes these giant prop bets when he plays live, you
know,
to encourage him to focus and play his best game, because he probably does get incredibly bored.
Mm-hmm.
it is a big challenge going. I mean, I've played a lot of live and online this year, like obviously more online. But when I've gone away to live tournaments and I've sat down after playing 12 tables on the computer, I've got one table, and it's like, oh, this is like a 24th of the speed. I'll talk to the guy next to me. How are you?
Yeah, exactly. And then you sort of get into at least in my experience, I've had occasions where I try to slow it down online and play fewer tables, but then I find my brain is almost moving so slowly that I'm getting distracted when I'm playing online. You know, so yeah. I have to reach like a sort of a perfect sort of focal point of a certain number of tables that my brain isn't overworked, but it's also not underworked, you know. And then playing live, you get the exact opposite thing, where there's nothing you can do to speed up the pace of the game. So you have to force yourself to, I mean, well, you either just let yourself get distracted and just look at your phone all day, or you have to force yourself to really look at your opponents and pick up as much information as you can. And in my experience, there's a ton of outside factors that have a big effect on that in live poker that most people don't even think about. I mean, one of the biggest ones would be how much sleep you got the night before. You know, I can't count how many times I've played a live tournament after not getting a good night's sleep and been like, oh man, I shouldn't have played this tournament.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. One thing about the World Series, when you've got day 1A, day 1B and day 1C, I literally reg the day that I've got the best sleep if I can. So I'll wake up the morning of day 1A and I'll not decide if I'm playing literally until I get to the event.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do this, and if I get there and I'm like, nope, not, I'm, I didn't sleep enough, I'm not rested enough, back home, repeat the cycle, hopefully day 1B I'm rested again. But day 2's, there's nothing you can do, you're in, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That certainly seems to be the nut way to do things, and that's by all means going to be the best way that I do things next summer if I'm back out in Vegas. I fired all 6 bullets at the Colossus last summer, which was the worst idea ever, because not only did I run extremely bad in all of them, I cashed once, but not only did I run really bad, but I also barely got any sleep for those whole 3 days. And if I had gone deep, I would have been exhausted and I probably would have punted it off. So
yeah.
It was just an absolutely terrible idea. And I'm much less experienced in live poker than a lot of people. So certainly it's a learning curve when you first dive in, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. All sorts of little tricks and tips you've got to learn to...
Yeah, absolutely. So on a bit of a different tack, I have a bunch of browser windows opened up right now doing my little bit of research about you before the podcast, and I've stumbled across a YouTube video of what is referred to as a Sky Poker grudge match. It seems to be you playing heads-up cash games on a tablet for about £50 against a boxer. Tell us a little bit about how that came around.
Was that Spencer Oliver?
That was Spencer Oliver, yeah.
He's such a good guy. The Sky Poker Show, it's such a shame that it stopped. I got invited on for a one-off quite a long time ago. And I guess they liked me because they asked me to come back regularly. And the show was essentially a celebrity. And the celebrity plays against a pro in a series of three challenges. One would be heads of cash for 40 minutes. Another one would be six max cash for 40 minutes. And the other one would be a silly challenge. It used to be chip stacking or something ridiculous.
Oh, okay.
Something really unpoker related, just for a bit of fun.
Yeah.
And the show was great because I got to meet all these celebrities. I met Matthew Hoggard. I met Spencer. Oh, nice. I met all these guys, and it was so fascinating to find these sort of heroes of their sort of genre, like boxing or cricket or football or whatever, now that they're retired and now what they're doing with themselves. And it's great, like, meeting these people. All the ones I met on the show personally were really these nice, down-to-earth, lovely people. But one thing that really sort of worried me was a bunch of them, like, not people they know, had encountered people who'd retired but still wanted the buzz. So you've got people who've gone from, I don't know, lifting the FA Cup or whatever, to retiring, to needing a new buzz.
Mm-hmm. And
that's been a dangerous transition for a number of them, from what I can tell.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, that was the interesting thing that I sort of hadn't really appreciated from the sort of sporting world.
The
Sky Show was great. But unfortunately, it just wasn't cost-effective way of advertising the Sky Poker platform. Unfortunately, they cut the funding, so...
Ah, that's a shame.
Yeah,
I watched a few minutes of it, and it seems there's an older gentleman sitting next to you on the couch here who's got a few interesting nuggets of poker advice. Do you remember who that was? I don't recognize him.
Is that TK? It must be TK.
It must be. He's a gentleman who, in this episode, he's wearing a beige jacket. He was talking in very animated terms about his poker advice. Yeah.
TK's a boss. You don't know TK?
No, I don't know.
Oh my gosh! You need to watch some Sky Poker episodes. TK.
I probably do.
He's a masterful troll. Whenever I was on the show with him, he used to wind me up the rotten. In a good way, though. He's TK smashing. I've got a lot of time for him.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it seems like a fun show to be a part of.
Yeah, it really was. Really enjoyed
it. Yeah, that show looked amazing. When Matt sent me that link, I was like, why don't we have stuff like this in America? Like, this looks so fun. I would watch poker again on TV.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's had a pretty good viewership, actually.
Yeah.
It was getting 60,000 people or something like that, which seems... Mm-hmm. Crazy to me.
It's funny, actually. One of my very early experiences with poker. I mean, I think I started playing probably late 2000. No, yeah, like very beginning of 2009. I think maybe like the first time I played was like New Year's Day 2009 or something. But
yeah,
around that time, I was working in a hotel, and I was working behind a bar, and it used to get dead quiet middle of the night, and we would always just have to have the TV on whatever channel, no one would be paying attention. And very frequently we'd have it on Sky Sports when some football game would finish, and then Sky Poker would come on. And, I remembered, like, we could never be bothered to change the channel or whatever, but Sky Poker would be on, and all these random people would come into the hotel bar and see what was on TV, and they'd be like, oh, it's just poker, and then just walk out again. And, and we were there, like, getting kind of curious about this weird poker show. 'Cause they used to have, I think, did they have people like phone in and play a hand over the phone or something weird like that? I can't remember, because I know they would have a guy in a studio, and they'd be displaying everybody's cards and in like a graphic in the background, and the guy would be commenting on it, and it was very unusual for a poker show. And I remember it piqued my interest, because this was just around the time when I was starting to watch stuff like Poker After Dark on YouTube and things like that. And
And
I think Sky Poker is, I think it's really one of the very, very few poker shows I've seen in the UK that actually succeeded in drawing a decent audience.
I agree. Like I say, it's a real shame that it wasn't a cost. I mean, it was silly that it wasn't. There was some weird loophole where they couldn't actually actively say, "Hey, this is the £100 game on Sky Poker tonight. Why didn't you come play?" That like there was some legal thing that they couldn't say that sentence.
Oh, really? That's weird.
Out. Yeah, it just seems bizarre because there were still adverts for gambling on, like the adverts on Sky Sports.
Yeah, if you watch Sky Sports these days, like literally, if you watch a football match or whatever, like almost every single advert or commercial for our American listeners will be a gambling one. Like it'll be Bet365 followed by SunBets followed by some other one, like four or five gambling commercials in a row for different companies. And that's the extent to which gambling is deregulated in the UK. But at the same time, for some reason, there's weird regulations about what you can and can't say on television in a broadcast TV show, which is really, really weird.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm sure. So are you still involved in taking part in any Sky Poker kind of promotions? Do they still have those going on, or is that like sort of something from last year?
That's I'm not aware of anything. Okay. It was just the Sky show for me. So unfortunately, no.
Okay. So then there's no plans to like resurrect that in some kind of other form then, I guess. That's a shame.
Not for Sky. I do have some plans in the pipeline for 2017, but I cannot divulge any more.
Oh, okay.
I really secretive. Wish I could. I'm just secret gonna, plans. I'm gonna have to tease you. You've got to watch this space. Cause I'm sure,
okay, yeah.
I'm 99% sure that I've got a good thing happening in 2017.
Yeah, we still haven't been able to convince any guests to give us any, like, you know, first-hand scoop information on this podcast. I think the closest we've come to some kind of big news revelation was Carlos telling us that he might actually not be living in his van anymore. you might correct me, but I don't think we've managed to get anybody to reveal any interesting news so far. So we'll have
everyone's
to keep trying.
Cryptic.
Everyone's very cryptic. Everyone's everyone wants to announce things on Twitter these days. That's the medium of choice.
So I know I see that you've gone back and played a bunch of summers in Vegas for the World Series of Poker. I assume you'll be making that trek again this year.
I'm really not sure this year. I think with this thing in the pipeline, it might get in the way of it a little bit. But aside from that, I've got a bunch of weddings. I've got a bunch of other big family events going on that time of year. And it's a big trip away from the wife. Like, the biggest thing for me in my lifestyle is balancing wife time and poker and social life aside from that. So being with Vegas for, I think I did four weeks. The longest stint I did in Vegas, that's a huge time to be away.
Yeah.
It was too long. Like after 2 weeks, we were both going crazy. After 3 weeks, I was just wanting to be home. So the next time I went out, I did 3 weeks. And even then, that still feels like too long. But of course, I want to be out there for as long as possible to make the most of it. So it's kind of a juggling act. And I actually don't think that would be a bad thing to take a year off from the World Series grind, even though it is a lot of fun, even though there's a lot of money to be made, there's a lot of glory to be had because everyone wants a bracelet. I will get one day. I'm telling you, watch this. We'll get one of those damn bracelets. But I think it'll be good for my mindset. I'll be a bit more hungry for it if I take a year off for it. And also the online games are really juicy around World Series time.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a chance I'll actually not go out to Vegas this year for those reasons. So
okay. Fair enough.
Yeah, 2 points on that. One is, you know, I've done the World Series for pretty much the full time for, I guess, like the last 4 or 5 years. And I think this year will be the first year I'm not going that long. I think I'm going to do 3 weeks because exactly what you said. It is a grind. And I know people really like watch it on Twitter and on Facebook and stuff. And they're like, oh, it's so fun. You get to be in Vegas for 2 months.
Yeah.
But they don't really realize what that means for your body and for your mind.
it's a bizarre town. Like, I love it, but it's so bizarre. Like, being around flashing lights all the time and noise all the time, it's just crazy.
Yeah.
It's a bizarre town. I love it, but it's a hard town to be there for that long. And the thing is, like, if we're out there playing poker, I mean, I don't know how, like, disciplined you guys are. I'm assuming very disciplined. But if I'm in Vegas for 3 weeks, I'll probably have, like, 2 nights out. Like, where I'm, you know, having a few drinks with the boys who are out there, you know? Like, the rest of the time, I'm not drinking. Maybe I'll go to a show, but I don't want to be up too late because I want to be fresh for the next day. So it's kind of like I am there to work. While I can have fun in Vegas, I do take the trip seriously because, you know, there's a lot of money at stake. I need to be at my best. So, sure.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's very difficult to have one foot in both mentalities, you know, to be trying to enjoy it for the sake of the trip and trying to also make the most of it on a professional basis, you know. So
absolutely,
it's definitely a difficult balance. I say this, this is slightly off topic, but I say this every time as well when we talk to someone from Britain or from Europe about going to Vegas, but how do you handle the heat out there? Because you cannot go outside if you're from the UK, can you?
I suffer so much in the heat.
Me too.
Everyone laughs at us, but I'd rather go somewhere cold. I'd rather go to Iceland than go to Vegas in terms of climate. I really would.
It's funny you say that because I'm sitting here in Warsaw right now, and it's like -3 Celsius, which I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, but it's been snowing all day. And
that sounds lovely.
Yeah, well, it's quite nice when you know when you haven't seen snow for a while. But then, you know, two weeks from now, I'm going to be in Mexico, and it's going to be you know, perfect sunny weather, which isn't too hot, not like Vegas. So it's going to be great. So I'm constantly torn between the two because I'm ginger, so I can't go out in the sun very easily.
Man.
But also, I don't like the cold that much because I've experienced so much of it growing up in the UK. So it's a balancing act, I guess.
Man, you've got it harder than anyone.
I do, yeah. I can't really go out in Vegas at all. It's like I've had experiences where I've like the wife and I had an experience where we took our car in to be serviced or something, and to get to where we were going to hang out while we were waiting for it to be done, we had to walk across like a big empty car park or parking lot for our American listeners, and it was this, you know, probably no longer than about a 300 meter walk or something, and it felt like running a marathon because it was 42 degrees Celsius out there.
It's brutal.
It's about 110 Fahrenheit or whatever. And I was there was me with no big hat to cover me or anything, having to brave this walk across what felt like a desert to get to the other side. And so certainly there's some ups and downs to Vegas, that's for sure.
There are tricks to get out of the heat though. Like if you want to walk down the strip, it's actually quicker because of the crowds, but it's also cooler to like duck into each casino.
Oh yeah, I always do that. Yeah, for sure.
You skip through the casino; it's quicker, it's nice and air-conned, and that's how I get around in Vegas.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you've got to do that, but then I suppose if you're off the strip, which my wife and I have been a fair amount, we've actually done the full like 2 months both of the last couple of summers because my wife's from the US, and whenever you're spending time anywhere that's not on the strip, of course, your average random building is not going to be connected to the other buildings next to it. So you have to come out and go back in again. And that's the hard part, I suppose. It's a tricky one. But, I tell you what, one of the weirdest experiences for me was the first time I got to Vegas and experiencing what it was like to be in really, really hot weather at night. Because it messed with my head. Like it was so hot that I felt like I should be getting sunburnt, but the sun wasn't even out. You know, it was like it was this total mind bending experience to be out in incredibly hot weather at night. So Vegas is a particularly interesting place for anyone from our part of the world, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely.
It's even interesting for people from this part of the world, for that matter.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah,
like, see some crazy things in Vegas.
Yeah, you said it was like walking across a desert, and that's because you were.
Yeah.
They just happened to lay some concrete on top of the desert.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. It's funny.
Very cool. So plans for the rest of, you said you got a lot of weddings and stuff like that coming up. Are you going to continue to focus on online for the time being? Got any live events coming up soon?
My next live event is the Unibet Open in the end of February, which is, you know, a big gap for me in terms of live poker. I'm going to be playing a bit less live, a bit more time at home with the wife, and a bit more online. So that's the plan.
Cool.
I can't reveal the bigger plan. I really wish I could. If this podcast had been recorded in 2 months' time, I could have shared some big news. But I can't.
That's all right. We'll just let people know that they can follow you on Twitter at Ian Simpson Poker, because I'm sure you'll be announcing the news there. And I know Matt and I will certainly be
absolutely
following along to see what happens there as well.
Right, well, indeed.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Ian, for joining us. Really appreciate it. Love to have you back on the show someday.
Sounds good to me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Sounds great.
All right, guys. Thank you all for tuning in out there in the podcast world. We look forward to having you guys back for more Mid-Stakes Living podcasts in the very near future. In the meantime, take care, and we'll see you soon.
Bye-bye, guys. Everybody.